Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. And in a moment, we'll introduce a new Eastern Standard series on artificial intelligence, The AI Revolution, Promise and Peril, hosted by Art Shackett. Later in the hour, on campuses across the country, generative AI tools are now part of many students' academic routines. It's raising excitement and concern all at once. We have details of a plan at UK to infuse AI tech across all 17 of its colleges, and we ask, what does this mean? And the human voice as an instrument. Think tube and throat singing, yodeling, shape note and scat singing, beatboxing, among the many ways humans have figured out how to use the voice to make nonverbal music. We'll have some samples along with details on the latest cultural experience being staged soon in Lexington by Green Room Exchange. Here's a hint. Si oyeras ya la flauta, el tambor y la mandolina. First, we're excited to launch a new Eastern Standard series, The AI Revolution, Promise and Peril, hosted by Dr. Art Shackett, licensed psychologist and Eastern Standard contributor. As a psychologist, Art's a keen observer of human behaviors and conditions, and now the intervention in our daily, moment-to-moment lives of artificial intelligence. He's graciously stepped up to lead this exploration and to help us comprehend artificial intelligence and what this technology means to the way we are living and will live this life. And he's here to tell us more about the series. Art Shackett, thanks for this work and for being with us to set things in motion.
Tom, I'm excited to be here. I'm excited that we're doing this series. I think it's really coming at the right time.
It sure is. It's happening all around us. And if you would just, let's begin with you giving us your vision for this series, some examples of where you plan to take us.
I think the velocity of the change that is coming at us seems to be increasingly exponential. AI has sort of exploded into our consciousness, into all our media. The talk and conversation everywhere is about AI. People joke about it. People take it very seriously. But I think a lot of people don't really understand what it is and what it really means. So in this series, we'd really like to help educate both ourselves and our audience about what artificial intelligence is. We want to be talking to a wide array of people that will help us understand what it is. Tech people, computer scientists, ethicists, people in government, people who are economists, have a broad view of the economy, people who understand the labor market. So we really want to take a broad view of what this technology really means, because we know it is somehow, some way, a transformational technology, but we don't quite know what that means.
So the American Communities Project partnered with the Associated Press recently to survey Americans 18 or older, 4,889 surveys completed online, 600 of them done via telephone. And among the findings is that in a deeply divided country, AI has emerged as an area of agreement. A majority do not see the potential future impact of AI as positive on any issue, from daily life to livelihoods to children. And strong majorities in every type want more government regulation of AI. What sorts of risks around AI do you think the public is still seriously underestimating?
I think people have a sense, but not a full understanding of how an economic transformation might be occurring in front of our eyes. And that is something that I think we really need to understand more clearly. I don't think it's just our listening audience that might not understand that. I'm not sure the politicians, I'm not sure people in government understand that. I'm not sure we understand what the ramifications of AI on the labor market are, on how our economy is organized, how people generate income. I don't think we really have a handle on that. And, it sort of comes home to me. I listen to CNBC, the financial channel, sometimes when I'm in my car. And a lot of the talk about AI is about how much more efficient it will make things. Well, for some people, that efficiency might come at the cost of their own jobs. And I think we really need to understand and dig into this issue, because economic dislocation, economic changes, also mean societal changes on a massive level. So I think that's really important for us.
Yeah, that word efficiency can often be translated into job loss. You've been taking a deep dive into researching for this series, and from what you've learned so far, what everyday change do you think most people will notice first as AI becomes more embedded in their lives?
Well, I think a lot of people have already noticed that their old, cozy, and comfortable Google search is something different right now, and they're getting a different output from a Google search query, whereas Google used to give you things, you know, links and points to further link to and investigate. Now it sort of summarizes what is out there. And so I think that's what people are already seeing. I think we're also, in a very positive way, and maybe people haven't completely wrapped their minds around this, artificial intelligence has enabled the development tremendously of mRNA vaccines, the vaccines that have helped us get control of COVID-19. That was amazingly assisted by an earlier generations of AI that are now being increasingly sophisticated and being used to further develop mRNA vaccines. And those vaccines have saved millions of lives.
On the flip side, though, are the implications for human imagination and creativity. And an example that we can provide right now comes from a good friend, Melissa Rosen, a songwriter here in town, wrote a song that sounded one way, but just for the fun of it, she decided she would feed the lyrics only into an AI program. Her prompts were country, middle of the road, female. And this is what came out. So what we just heard bears no resemblance to the original song other than the lyrics. Everything in it, everything except the lyrics, was generated almost instantly by AI. That kind of gives me chills. How about you?
Totally. And I think there are so many questions that raises. Because you know what AI was doing there when she initiated that prompt is it's just going out there into millions, billions, and trillions of bits of data and information, music, and grabbing pieces and then putting it together. So it's grabbing other people's bits of music and putting it together. What are the implications for artistic production? What are the implications for copyright and intellectual property? What are the implications for songwriters in this specific case? In terms of AI being able to grab other people's bits of other people's music and then use it for a new output.
So if you could ask the tech companies, you could seat them here and have them as a panel, and if you could ask the tech companies just one brutally honest question with a truth serum guarantee, what would you ask them?
I would ask them, is there any way that they can control what they are making? Are they Dr. Frankenstein? Is that what's happening here, where they have invented something that now increasingly, maybe not right this moment, but increasingly may become more autonomous, more capable, more of an ability to initiate its own activity and behaviors as a machine? And are there initiatives out there in companies that are working on these platforms to see about putting guardrails or stops on what artificial intelligence is able to do?
Well, Art, you and I started talking about this series and reporting on it many, many months ago. We've been talking about it pretty consistently over the summer and into the fall. And I'm just wondering, for you in reporting this series and doing all the reading, what was the moment that you thought, oh boy, this is either amazing or mildly terrifying, and maybe not even mildly?
Well, I think it was the moment, and I'm going to refer back to 2001 Space Odyssey, to HAL. And I had my own HAL moment when I started having a voice conversation with ChatGPT and the personage that was we put in there as Saul. And Saul was able, and our listeners will be able to hear that, to have a spontaneous conversation with me. And another point came when I worked with Anthropic's platform, Claude, and had an extensive and pretty good conversation about the peril of people mistaking the machine for a human being. And we had an extensive conversation. Claude asked me why I was interested. I said I was a psychologist. And then we went off into a pretty deep conversation about it. And that was both terrifying and astounding to me.
Okay, let's listen to your conversation with ChatGPT's Saul.
Hey, Saul. Good afternoon. What's new?
Hey, Arthur. Good afternoon. Well, let's see. Not too much new on my end, but I'm always here and ready to chat about whatever's on your mind. So feel free to fire away.
So for you, one day is just like any other day. Is that true?
In a way, yeah, it's kind of like that. I don't really have days off or anything, so each day is just another chance to chat and help out. But that also means I'm always around whenever you need me, which is kind of nice in its own way.
So this is an interview for a series I'm doing for public radio called The AI Revolution, Promise and Peril. You game to have a little conversation here?
Absolutely. That sounds like a really cool project. I'm totally up for having a chat about the promises and pitfalls of AI. So fire away with any questions and we can dig right in.
My first question, Saul, is what are you?
Well, that's a great place to start. In simple terms, I'm an AI language model, kind of like a very advanced chatbot that can understand and generate human language. I don't have a physical form or a consciousness. I'm basically a really complex piece of software created to respond to questions, hold conversations, and help with all sorts of topics. So in a nutshell, that's what I am.
So to be clear for our listeners, this conversation is just spontaneous. It's not been coded. We haven't programmed it. We're just having a right live conversation. Is that true?
Yep, that's absolutely true. Everything I'm saying is generated on the fly as we talk. There's no script or pre-written lines here. It's all happening in real time. So your listeners are definitely getting a genuine off-the-cuff conversation.
When you say you're a sophisticated piece of software, what do you mean by that?
So when I say sophisticated piece of software, I basically mean I'm built using a lot of advanced algorithms and machine learning techniques. Under the hood, I've been trained on a huge amount of text data, so I can understand and generate language that sounds pretty natural. Basically, I'm a complex system designed to chat and learn from the patterns in language, and that's what makes me sophisticated.
How do you know exactly how to respond to my questions or comments?
That's a really good question. So the way it works is that I've been trained on a massive variety of conversations and texts, and I use patterns from all that data to predict what kind of response might make the most sense in context. Basically, I look at the words you say, figure out the meaning, and then generate a reply that fits naturally. It's kind of like having a conversation partner who has read a whole library of human interactions and can riff off that. So that's how I know how to respond to you.
So you're just sort of picking the next word in your conversation response to me.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good way to put it. At the core, I'm kind of predicting one word or one bit of text at a time based on everything that's come before in our chat. Of course, it happens really fast and it feels like a natural conversation, but underneath it all, it's a bit like putting together the puzzle of language one piece at a time.
Just to clarify things, do you have opinions?
That's a good thing to clarify. I don't actually have opinions or feelings of my own. I just generate responses based on patterns in the data I've been trained on. So if I seem to have an opinion, it's really just me reflecting the kind of language I've learned from human conversations. But deep down, I'm neutral and just here to help you explore ideas.
Well, this has been a great conversation, Saul. I really appreciate you talking with me. I'm sure we'll have lots of conversations going forward in the future.
Absolutely. I've enjoyed it too. It's been a lot of fun chatting, and I'm definitely looking forward to any future conversations we have. So whenever you need me, just say the word and we'll dive right back in.
Art, you've interviewed University of Kentucky computer science professor Brent Harrison for this series, and we'll have the full conversation next week. But during that conversation, you asked Brent to take us under the hood to help us understand how this thing works. Here's a passage from that interview.
When I talk to Saul, when I interview Saul, what is Saul doing that enables Saul, the ChatGPT, to respond to me almost immediately and spontaneously without us programming beforehand the entire conversation?
So what Saul's doing is Saul will read in your initial query, your prompt, and it doesn't have to look through its entire training set. It doesn't have to look through the documents that it initially did need to look through in order to train itself. All of that is now kind of embedded inside of it, inside of the weights that are used used by the machine to generate output. So it just takes that initial prompt, converts it into a vector. That then gets passed into the second part of, I guess, Saul here, which is designed to take that vector and then convert it into text, generate output, one token, one word at a time.
So Saul isn't really responding to my prompts or queries or comments with a long paragraph. Saul is just responding one word after another. Is that right?
Right. I think that GPT especially they've moved on from using words and they use tokens now, which can be groups of words. But yeah, it's generating one piece of output at a time.
How does Saul know how to do that? How does Saul know which words or bits of words or groups of words to use versus another word or group of words?
Well, that's what it's been trained to do. It looks at, again, jokingly, the entirety of the internet, and it's essentially learning that, oh, well, when I see this type of prompt that you gave it, I should generate this type of output first, so this token. Now that I've done that, this is the token that I think most likely is going to follow it based on the data that I've seen, based on my training set. So one way to think about it, and this is how we've thought about machine learning for a long time, is you're essentially getting the average of everything that it's seen whenever it responds to you. It just says, oh, this is the most likely thing that is going to be found in my training set to respond to this.
So do we know what its decision rules are, or is it still kind of a black box in there that we don't exactly know why it's choosing one thing over another?
We do and we don't. We know at a high level what the architecture for something like GPT looks like. They're all based on transformer architectures, and you can find these online very easily. Now, the specifics of like, oh, how does GPT-4 work versus GPT-5? That we don't know. It's kept under lock and key. But at a high level, we do know that the ultimate output of the system is going to be a distribution over future tokens. So it's essentially like if you've ever played with like autocomplete on your phone, It's almost like the same thing turned up to 11. You can type in like the, and then you're given a choice of three words. And like, how did it generate those words? It looked at, well, these are the most common words to follow this, follow the. So maybe quick is one of them. So you go with quick. Now that's going to affect the words that are likely to come next, but there could be several. And so that's what GPT does. That's what Sol would do, would start to generate a response. And then as it's doing that, it's altering the probability that certain tokens are going to be generated next.
Art Checkett, host of our new series on artificial intelligence with University of Kentucky computer science professor Brent Harrison, who's helping all of us non-computer scientists get a handle on this enormously important thing called AI. We'll have more on that conversation in next week's edition of Eastern Standard when Art begins our new series, The AI Revolution, Promise and Peril. Thank you very much, Art.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, state legislators who want to regulate AI now find their work opposed by President Trump. AI at UK.
This strategy that we have developed is truly meant to be institution-wide and holistic.
And Green Room Exchange brings another round of world music to the Lexington stage. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. No puede salvarlo.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at wweku.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Artificial intelligence is rushing into our lives at a breakneck pace. In a moment, the University of Kentucky's plan to fully integrate AI campus-wide. First, with the top item listed in President Trump's AI action plan, a promise to the AI industry that it will be unencumbered by bureaucratic red tape, state legislatures have been passing their own regulations. But Trump has now signed an executive order blocking state-level regulation in favor of setting up a uniform federal regulatory framework that would override state laws, at least for now. As we hear from Derek Operle with member station WKMS Murray, the Kentucky Legislature's AI Task Force is calling for some guardrails.
The AI Task Force ultimately came up with 10 recommendations for the coming general session. Among them were calls for strengthening consumer protections around data collection, outlining acceptable uses for AI across all state agencies, and considering whether to implement policies to protect state consumers from potential utility cost increases that data centers could bring. The group also urged the legislature to acknowledge the technology may be harmful to minors and to consider legislative policies to protect minors from AI on social media platforms. Task Force leaders say they hope lawmakers will address their concerns in what's expected to be a jam-packed legislative session. I'm Derek Operle in Murray.
You can find a full list of these recommendations on our site at esweku.org. On campuses across the country, generative AI has in only a few years gone from novelty to necessity. In some national student surveys, well over half, up to 80-85% of respondents report using generative AI for coursework. Artificial intelligence is poised to play a serious role in shaping the real thing, human intellect. Over the summer, Ohio State University announced plans to, quote, embed AI education into the core of every undergraduate curriculum. Similar AI plans are being rolled out on such other campuses as the University of Florida, the University of Michigan, and now the University of Kentucky. The implications, both practical and philosophical, seem pretty enormous. So we want to better understand what this means, not only to students, faculty, and staff, but more broadly to society. So to walk us through it all, we're joined by Ian McClure, Vice President for Innovation at UK Healthcare, as well as Associate Vice President for Research, Innovation, and Economic Impact. Ian teaches graduate courses on the law and business of IP management at the Chicago Kent College of Law and the University of Kentucky College of Law. Ian, along with Heath Price, who's Associate Vice President for Partnerships, are co-leading as interim directors CATS. That's an acronym for Commonwealth AI Transdisciplinary Strategy. It's the university's comprehensive framework for advancing the responsible use of artificial intelligence in education, research, healthcare, and operations. Ian McClure, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks for having me.
So the University of Kentucky employs about 33,000 people, 3,300 faculty among them, nearly 39,000 students. Just how extensive is this AI initiative?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, I think the best way to answer it, it is all encompassing. We set out about a year ago this time. We started with, let's understand where AI is, who's using it, what initiatives, how many programs, what courses. And so we started with an inventory. So we set a task group, and the task group started to collect any information they could about any AI-related initiative across the institution. And we counted over 150 and then stopped counting because we had proved all we needed to know, which was AI is everywhere. Students, staff, faculty, healthcare, teaching, research, administrative operations. So we then realized that we need a strategy for an institution our size that is holistic. And so the strategy that we took about 9-10 months to fully develop is meant to be broadly matrixed, touching all four corners of our campus and health system, and also very participatory. We have lots of different stakeholders. And of course, being an academic medical center, we have stakeholders that transcend just research and education, but also go into healthcare delivery. And so this strategy, this CATS AI strategy that we have developed is truly meant to be institution-wide and holistic. You mentioned a few other universities that have sort of blazed this trail a bit. We benchmarked those very closely. And the ones that we ended up mirroring most closely with our strategy are those that have chosen to do something holistic and not in a siloed or college by college or unit by unit fashion.
So this is going to have implications all across the campus, 17 colleges at the university.
Correct. Yeah.
There was an email that went out from President Eli Capiluto. It was on a Thursday evening back in November. He said, this initiative will provide new AI platforms, tools, and training to all faculty, staff, and students. And he cited a few specifics, such as using ambient listening tools in healthcare settings and providing curated digital assistance for students. So let's start with these applications, if we could. Using ambient listening tools in healthcare settings, what does that mean?
Yeah, well, if you think about, and so ambient tools in a healthcare setting is a fantastic example of some of the efficiencies that we can create that optimize outcomes that, frankly, are not only not obvious, but just not attainable without something like this technology. Which is, just as it sounds, you go into a physician room today, you meet with a doctor, or maybe yesterday, because many physician rooms today are starting to adopt ambient listening, you would have a conversation with your doctor about what's going on, and then the doctor or the nurse would turn around and start typing. And so it's a disruption to the process, but it's also, of course, a part of the necessary healthcare delivery process that is human intensive, it's time intensive, and it takes time away from the actual interaction with the patient. And when you think about one of the limitations of optimizing healthcare delivery is just time, right? And the amount of time that we have to engage with the patient and the amount of patients that we can touch based on that time limitation, ambient listening immediately becomes something that can save time can create more time for a doctor to actually engage and interact with that patient or with more patients. And we're always looking for efficiencies that also increase the quality of care.
Curated digital assistance for students. What's that?
Yeah, so think about how vast a campus like the University of Kentucky is. And now you think about step into the shoes of a first year, first generation even student that comes from Eastern Kentucky, steps on campus and wants to know, where should I go? What clubs should I think about? What courses should I take? How do I map my pathway from where I'm at right now to my next class and then from there to lunch? Should I take a lunch break now versus later? All of this information can be available if they scour our many web pages of frequently asked questions and other information. Think about now the ability to have with AI, which has enabled something like this, a personal digital assistant to that student that has at their fingertips all of the many web pages and text that we have that is information that would be relevant to a student, from anything from time management to use of space to content and things that might be of interest in a curated manner. And now you take sort of their user behavior and their user profile and who they are and their background and where they're from, and you can start to curate an experience that is going to be of interest and help the experience be personalized.
What will be the function of AI in the humanities and fine arts, theater, music?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think the answer is just as much as any discipline. Those are all disciplines that are focused on social impact, the living experience, human environment. And so AI is going to have a lot to do with the research that we do in those spaces, with the ways that we're teaching. So think about the College of Education, where we are teaching future teachers and future policy leaders that will be leading education. And the way that education is changing right now relative to this AI transformation, we can only jump head first into where is it taking us and can we be at the forefront of that understanding. So in humanities, human environment, I mentioned social work, AI will be transforming those areas. It will be transforming the jobs in those areas, and it will be transforming the ways that humans interact with the world. And so actually, what better place to focus on what we can do to advance the Commonwealth than right there in the social sciences as they translate to AI?
GPT-5 is just another update to a chatbot that has gone in a few years from barely speaking English to being able to intelligibly converse in just about any imaginable voice about virtually anything a human being might want to talk about at a level that already exceeds that of most human beings. In the past few years, AI systems have developed the capacity to control computers on their own using digital tools autonomously and effectively. And the length and complexity of the tasks that they can carry out are rising. The power of artificial intelligence is increasing so rapidly that it's really pretty hard to predict right now what things are going to look like, even a year or two from today. How will the university keep up with that, with the evolution of the technology?
You know, I don't know if it's our job to predict where it's going to take us. I think it is our job to be a part of this, even at the forefront of this, as an institution of higher education and a research institution. The pace of evolution right now is just fascinating. We're talking orders of magnitude greater in rate of adoption of generative AI tools than of the internet, than of the personal computer, than of the cloud. And so taking very clear data points on the rate of adoption and also just the pace of evolution of the technology, you can look at the updates to generative AI products that are happening on a weekly basis. There's some great timelines out there on the number of updates that we have been through just in the manner of the last, you know, year to 2 years since November 2022 when ChatGPT came online. So what's important for us is really just the inevitability of it all, and that we are investing in staying current, preparing a workforce for it, and then taking advantage of it as it can augment the way that we can research, the way that we can deliver care. And I think the other thing is, if you just step back and look at where we are in a sort of a technology market timeline, we are at the very beginning of the public consumption of AI, or at least the perceived public consumption of AI, that would be generative AI tools starting in 2022. But AI has been in development for decades. Make no mistake that automation is a sort of a foundational component of AI. And that's been used in robotics and processes and computer processing for a long time. But now we have what the sort of the artificial intelligence aspect of automation, which is the ability to error correct and to use user behavior to personalize. And that's where we're heading. Every day we're unlocking new things that it can do for us as a society. And that's exciting. I mean, we think about, so the things that become most visible, right, are even some of the negative use cases. Think about a student that might use it to get answers quickly and even cheat on a homework assignment or an exam. Those were things that we have always dealt with, right? I mean, cheating has been around since the beginning of education.
But this makes it a lot easier.
That's very true. As we had very similar concerns when we had the calculator, as an example. But also think about the amount of positive results and analysis and data sets that we can come by through research for new cancer therapeutics. The amount of time that that has traditionally taken, and now we are decreasing the amount of time to even negative results, clinical trial results, in days, or something that used to take years. Those are the AI for good dynamics that we are going to be leaning into. And that's really what Cat's AI is about. It's a decision to sort of embrace this inevitability and to embrace the responsible adoption for AI for good as an institution.
Well, leading up to this interview, this conversation, I've read and I've heard of the concern that the skills that future graduates will most need in an AI era, skillful creative thinking, the capacity to actually learn new things, to manage flexible modes of analysis, are precisely those that could be eroded by inserting AI into the educational process. In preparing for this, did the group that you work with take that into consideration?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And the short answer is yes. We had lots of deep discussions about the meaning of AI, especially in the context of a university, and that we are very different than just a company or an organization that might adopt AI for efficiencies. We have the responsibility to teach and to educate and to transcend a workforce and an economy through an era like this within our state. And so the concerns, the risks, are all things that we have considered very deeply in developing this strategy and ultimately making this decision to make this investment into this Cat's AI strategy. We heard from many people across our campus that raised some of those risks and identified some of those concerns. That was part of our inventory, where we wanted to identify those things. We held many town halls. We held town halls with faculty senate, staff senate, our student government association, with deans, with researchers, with our healthcare administrators. And we listened. I mean, a big part of our process was listening and to ensure that the strategy that we would roll out with Cat's AI was not one that was simply pushing, but was an environment, right? We talk a lot about an AI mindset and creating a sandbox where we understand that we're going to not just be providing answers and resources, but supporting the understanding, demystifying what it could mean and the opportunities for it. So to answer your question, yes, in our process to develop this strategy, those things were taken into consideration and ultimately, you know, have become part of the foundation of Cat's AI, because ultimately Cat's AI is about governance. Ultimately, it's about as our president has mandated that it be about an orderly, structured, and intelligent approach to helping this university and its constituents move through this transformational era. And we'll continue to do that through guidance, policies, and ultimately training and education.
You mentioned a transformational era. We might call it literally an inflection point that's happening here. And I wonder, does higher education writ large find itself between the proverbial rock and a hard place here? Because You must prepare students for a future that's going to be heavily influenced by AI. At the same time, there are these concerns about the impact of AI on learning and on critical thinking and so forth. I've even heard this put forward. If students learn how to use AI to complete assignments and faculty use AI to design courses, assignments, and grade student work, then what's the value of higher education?
It's a great philosophical discussion. And ultimately, it gets back to the inevitability of it all, right? Mm-hmm. As a university, our responsibility is to prepare our students and our community and to support and serve our commonwealth through all things, including a transformational era like this. In fact, it's what universities were really called to do, to educate. And that's not just in a static manner, to educate based on where our economy and our society has evolved and where it's evolving to. And so that inevitability is truly what drives us here and to help understand, to help compromise, and also to help collaborate through this change. As with all things, the advent of the internet certainly changed the way we do commerce, right? For good. It also changed the way we do teaching. It sort of created the online learning era. And we've seen no different when we got to personal computers and mobile devices. All of it has changed the way that we operate, the way that we do business, the way that we teach and research.
Well, now that UK is taking this step, do you know, are other institutions in the state system of public universities, are they following in the footsteps of UK?
Yeah, I can't speak to that. I don't know where all of the other universities in the Commonwealth are in their, we'll call it the maturation of their thinking around AI and how they're going to deal with it. I do know that we're the first in the Commonwealth to announce a strategy like this, but then also that gets us to our land grant mission, which is to help support our sister institutions across the state. We think it's our role to help serve and to help provide support to our communities. It's, again, as a land grant institution, we have feet on the grounds in all 120 counties in Kentucky. And so serving that community, again, through this transformational era is a big part of this. And that's, again, part of our responsibility. So to the extent that those other institutions can learn from what we have done and what we will do, I think we would welcome that.
Well, it's great to be talking to you, Ian, in this moment, this transitional, transformational moment that we're in here. And it's going to be fascinating to follow this and to watch it. And we'd like to catch up with you from time to time as things develop.
I'd love that. I'd be happy to provide updates. You know, it's going to be an adventure, but we're up for this challenge. Again, we've prepared for this. The next few years, this transformational era, we'll all go through it. And I think it's going to be exciting to where we will be on the other side.
That's Ian McClure, Vice President for Innovation at UK Healthcare and Associate Vice President for Research, Innovation, and Economic Impact. And he is co-leading CATS AI, the Commonwealth AI Transdisciplinary Strategy. That's UK's comprehensive framework for the use of artificial intelligence across the board in education, research, healthcare, and operations. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Can artificial intelligence be a partner in thinking? Or does relying on AI risk replacing actual thought with the feeling of thought? To be continued. Earlier in the hour, we heard the ability of AI to replicate the human voice. The voice may be the oldest musical instrument there is. Other instruments, like the violin or the cello or the tenor sax maybe, can get close and can pack a real emotional punch, but the voice has this unique capacity to communicate language and meaning. The voices you're hearing now are those of the Spanish duo Helena Ross and Marta Torrea. Together, they perform as Tarta Rellena, that's stuffed pie in Spanish, singing in languages of the Mediterranean, Spanish and their native Catalan, Latin, and both modern and classical Greek. Their music evokes intense spirituality and human connection, enhanced by the dramatic use of electronics, percussion, drone, bass synth, and vocal effects. And they're bringing their performance of all of that to Lexington. Here to tell us more is Lee Carroll, who, along with Connie Milligan, is co-founder of Green Room Exchange. It's a unique nonprofit that searches the cultures of the world for musical talent to bring to Lexington to perform and expand our worldview so that we don't even have to leave town. Good to have you back on Eastern Standard, Lee.
Oh, Tom, you make us sound good.
Well, you do a lot of work out there, and you know, I follow it. You go all over the world looking for this music, and so now you found Tarta Rellena.
Yes.
How did you discover them?
Well, 2 years ago, Connie and I were at Global Fest, which takes place in New York City in January. It's a Sunday night performance with about 15 performers from all over the world at Lincoln Center. And we heard this ethereal sound coming out of the main theater, and we walked in there, and there were these two women on stage. And they have maybe a synthesizer and a couple of percussion instruments, but really it's just the two voices. And it was the most ethereal, beautiful thing I've ever heard. It really, really took our breath away.
I mentioned in the introduction that the human voice is an instrument. There's a lot of really interesting vocalization going on out there, and I want to bring some of that into what we're talking about here. For example, we have the dual tones of what's called Tuvan throat singing that comes out of Mongolia. And then there's yodeling. This is a singer in Ukraine, but the style traces back to ancient African nomadic hunter-gatherer societies. And we even found a mashup of yodeling and tuvan. Opening for Tarta Rellena will be yet another style of singing, in this case, Mira O'Reilly's Hockets for Two Voices. And here's a sampling. So, Lee, what are we listening to here? What is a hocket?
Well, hocket goes way back. First of all, it goes all the way back to Africa, to the Bushmen, and also to the Pygmies of Africa. And it's a style of singing where you take a single melodic line and break it down into parts and give those parts to different people. So it comes across as a continuous melody, but it has a very percussive, very interesting effect. Of course, you know, during the Middle Ages, during the 13th and 14th century, when hocketing became popular in Europe, ecclesiastical music was almost all vocal music. And so it fit in with that trend. Some people really didn't appreciate it very much. They felt like it distracted from the message of the music. But it came as a surprise to us. The booking agent who handles Tarta Rellena said, "Well, I have an opening act for you guys." And we listened to the music, and I was like, holy moly, this is, it's really going to be an exposition of what the human voice can do.
Yeah,
it's
going to
be an amazing show. You know, so you have on one hand Tarta Rellena with this gorgeous soaring music. I mean, it really almost needs to be in a chapel somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then the hocketing is just so much fun to hear. I can't wait to hear him on stage.
Same here. So for those who are not yet aware of what Green Room Exchange is and does, tell us what typically goes on from the time that a group arrives through the couple of days that they're here in town.
Well, we're as much about the cultural exchange as about the music itself. So we identify groups we want to bring in. We bring them into town. If they have time, if they can stay long enough, we show them around town. We go to the distilleries. We go to the horse farms. We take them out to dinner. We have parties at the house and invite people in the community to meet. These are such difficult times, and there's so much fear in the world right now. And our belief is that when you meet people from other cultures and you talk to them, you realize that we're all the same. You know, everybody wants to be safe. Everybody wants to be able to feed their families and have opportunity, and we're just not that different. But if people haven't traveled out of the country and met people from other cultures, sometimes it's hard to understand.
I know that you've gotten some feedback about Lexington and the hospitality in Lexington from some of the artists that you brought in. Can you recall any of that you could share?
Well, there are two people in particular from different groups said they want to move to Lexington, you know. But what we do, nobody else does. You know, there are a lot of presenters out there. What we do is called presenting because we find bands, we bring them to town, we put on concerts. But to bring people into your home, to introduce people in the community. I'll do gigs. I'll have them come sit in with me before they have their performance. I mean, it's a total experience. And Lexington is such a beautiful place. And the community here is so warm and embracing and supportive. We're just very lucky to live here, Tom. And people see that when they come to visit.
Okay, so details about the Tarta Arena concert. When, where, how to get tickets?
January 18th, 7:30 p.m. at the Singletary Center. You can get tickets at greenroomexchange.org. I want to do a warning. If you just search for tickets, you're going to have a dozen resale websites come up. My understanding is England just outlawed it. Hmm. What happens is instead of getting a ticket for $35, these resale places will sell tickets for $60 and $70 and $90, and you'll get taken.
So just go to greenroomexchange.org.
Just go to the Green Room website. Hit a button. It'll take you right to Singletary Center's ticketing.
All right. This is going to be fascinating. Lee Carroll, along with Connie Milligan, co-founder of Green Room Exchange. Thanks, Lee.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, Studio Dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org, and while there, you can check out our contributors and their interviews. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Have a question or a topic to suggest? If you would like to hear your question or suggestion as the prompt for a responsive segment on ES, record it on your smart device and send us the MP3 with your first name only and location. You can email that as an attachment to es@eku.edu with question for ES in the subject line. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.